The subject for the second talk is the problem of contextualization in a decadent culture. The word contextualization comes out of missiology from the 70s and 80s, which stressed the necessity of attending to a cultural context as we are preaching, concern that I heartily endorse, but as I think I'll make clear, that contextualization is often prophetic and not simply adaptive, that we need to attend to the cultural setting that we're in, but sometimes we need to be deliberately countercultural in the process of doing that. I want to start with some historical observations, and since I'm in a church music place, I think this is an appropriate anecdote. In the second volume of his treatise, Syntagma Musicum, published in 1619, I think you have the first edition of that in your office, if I'm not mistaken, the composer and musician Michael Praetorius wrote the following: "Almighty God alone can never be given sufficient thanks for having granted to man in his mercy and great goodness such gifts as have enabled him to achieve such a perfect, one might almost say the most perfect creation and instrument of music as is the organ, in its arrangement and construction, and to play upon it with hands and feet in such a manner that God in heaven may be praised, his worship adorned, and many moved and inspired to Christian devotion." I want to call your attention to the fact that Praetorius does not commence his praise for this gift by saying how much he likes the sound of the organ. Rather, he first calls attention to its perfection of arrangement and construction. It's how the thing works that impresses him. And Praetorius was one of a very long line of Christian thinkers who commented on the virtues of the organ in its mechanism as a symbol of cosmic harmony. Long before organs were permitted in churches, which was probably sometime in the 10th century, they were praised by Christians for the way in which their mechanism was a concrete, visible, and audible metaphor for spiritual realities. Tertullian, for example, no friend of pagan culture, Tertullian of "What Hath Jerusalem to Do with Athens" fame, nevertheless praised the predecessor of the pipe organ in his treatise on the soul, De Anima, written in the early 3rd century. In commenting on the unity and diversity of the soul, Tertullian writes, quote, "A single body is made up of various members, so that there is unity and not a division. Observe that marvelous creation of Archimedes. I speak of the hydraulic organ," it was a water organ, "with its many parts, sections, connections, passages, such a collection of sound, variety of tone, array of pipes, and yet it all constitutes a single entity. So too, the air, expelled from below by the agitation of the water, is not thereby divided into parts because it is distributed into different places. Rather, it is one in substance, though diverse in function." In the 12th century, not long after organs had been admitted into churches, a certain Bishop Baldric, who served in the northwestern section of France, which became the province of Normandy, wrote the following in a letter to the people of one of his parishes: "For myself, I take no great pleasure in the sound of the organ, but it encourages me to reflect that, just as diverse pipes of differing weight and size sound together in a single melody as a result of the air in them, so men should think the same thoughts and, inspired by the Holy Spirit, unite in a single purpose. All this I have learned from the organs installed in this church. Are we not the organs of the Holy Spirit? And let any man who banishes them from the church likewise banish all vocal sound, and let him pray with Moses through motionless lips. For ourselves, we speak categorically, because organs are a good thing, if we regard them as mysteries and derive from them a spiritual harmony. It is this harmony that the moderator of all things has instilled in us by putting together elements entirely discordant in themselves and binding them together in a harmonious rhythm. As we listen to the organs, let us be drawn together by a deeper harmony and be cemented together by a twofold charity." As musicologist Quentin Faulkner observes, the early appearance of organs in churches may well not have been so much for practical music making as for symbolic and didactic ends. Symbolic in that the instrument was the material embodiment of cosmic harmony. In addition to the symbolism of the organ's mechanism, Faulkner also notes that there were aspects of the quality of sound that was theologically attractive. Early medieval organs were quite different from the pipe organs we have today. Originally, they had only a single rank of pipes, and the sound that they produced was rather austere and unexciting. But that was seen as a virtue. As Faulkner writes, the very quality of the sound produced by the medieval organ had an affinity to the Christian ideal of cosmic harmony and to the objective, non-affective music which that ideal produced. That is, they wanted music that people didn't get too much involved with. In other words, music was not a means to excite emotion immediately, but to convey an oral impression of the objective structure of the universe. Faulkner continues, the sound had practically no expressive qualities, and only the slightest capacity for nuance, if indeed it had any at all. Little variety in tone, very little rhythmic capabilities, no potential for crescendo and diminuendo. It was remote in its playing mechanism, remote from its listeners, often in a balcony or swallow's nest high up on the church wall. You couldn't see the organist. There was no one visible. And in a remote, mystic, and awe-inspiring acoustic environment. Its most unique musical characteristic, the ability to hold a tone at a static dynamic level, theoretically endlessly, was distinctly superhuman. If one assumes, as the Middle Ages did, that variation and fluctuation belong to the human sphere, while awe, remoteness, and constancy are characteristic of the divine, the mysterious, the holy, then the qualities enumerated above would seem to render the organ a peculiarly hieratic musical instrument, that is, a priestly one. Now, I'm sharing this material with you neither to launch a defense of organs in church music, nor to endorse without reservation late medieval views of the nature of the divine and the human. What I want to introduce is a question of criteria for the church's embrace of cultural change. At some time 1,000 years into its history, the church decided to change its tradition of exclusively a cappella music and allow the introduction of an instrument with centuries of pagan associations into its liturgical life. And if Quentin Faulkner's telling of this story, and it's in his book Wiser Than Despair, if Quentin Faulkner's telling of this story is correct, and I think there are reasons to give it credence, the rationale for the church's decision to make this dramatic change was not because the instrument was generally popular and lots of people would like it. Your average medieval churchgoer had less experience with organ music than your average American teenager does today. And it wasn't because worship leaders regarded the instrument as a useful tool in generating enthusiasm and a sense of participation in the worship experience. In fact, from Bishop Baldrick's remarks, one gets the impression that unless the benefits of the organ had been explained to them, it would have held little implicit attraction. The organ had little in the way of immediate or widespread popular subjective appeal. The use of the organ was deemed fitting because its way of working, the way it produced sound, the kind of sounds it produced, had a likeness to cosmic and spiritual realities. Fittingness, not popularity or effectiveness, was a criterion. It was meet and right so to do, to quote from Cranmer. Not only was the instrument itself fitting, but the kind of music it played well was appropriate for divine worship. The theologians and church leaders of the period assumed that there was an order in creation which could be apprehended and known in music. That's why music, along with arithmetic, geometry, and astronomy, was one of the four disciplines included in the quadrivium, the four ways, which completed the classical trivium of grammar, logic, and rhetoric, which together comprised the seven liberal arts. If you wanted to prepare to study theology and philosophy in the medieval universities, you had to study music first. Music was the experience of the numeric reality of the cosmos in time. Even today, people describe music as a way of ordering time, a way of perceiving that order, the order that is time. For medieval thinkers, in fact, for most Western thinkers prior to the modern period, the order of the cosmos was a standard for guiding the order of the soul and the order of society. In the words of theologian Colin Gunton, I'm quoting him a lot today, aren't I? I didn't realize I had so many quotes from him. There was an assumption that human life is good life when it conforms itself to the way things truly are, when it takes shape in the world as it truly is. Gunton points out, and this is in his book, The One, the Three, and the Many, that in general it was held in the ancient world that knowledge of the universe contained the key to human society. In other words, culture and society had to be shaped in accord with something given in the nature of things, and one could observe creation and discover realities there that gave us clues as to how we ought to order society. Louis Dupré, who's a religion historian, has summarized pre-modern Christian beliefs this way: a divinely established cosmic order determines man's place and prescribes the norms of behavior. The entire universe is conceived as a gift endowed with meaning that is man's task to discover and express. In fulfilling this task, man finds at the same time his own meaning, the content of which is given in the two books of nature and revelation. Largely modern culture dispenses with the idea that creation is something that we can gain wisdom about life from. As modern people, we tend to think of nature as just a lot of resources. It's a lot of raw material awaiting us to do interesting things to ourselves. It's not the view of the scriptures. Throughout the Psalms, throughout wisdom literature, you see the attitude repeatedly that creation has an order about it that we are well to attend. One of my favorite passages in the Old Testament on this is actually 1 Kings chapter 4, which contains a description of Solomon's wisdom. It reads a little bit like Solomon's resume or CV. It reads, "And God gave Solomon wisdom and understanding beyond measure, and breadth of mind like the sand on the seashore, so that Solomon's wisdom surpassed the wisdom of all the people of the East and all the wisdom of Egypt." And actually lists guys that he was wiser than, which is not a good thing to do on your resume. I'm smarter than Bill, and I'm a lot smarter than Susan is. And then the text reminds us that Solomon spoke 3,000 proverbs and composed 1,005 songs. It's his list of publications, like you put on any good CV. We're given a glimpse of the content of Solomon's wisdom, a summary of the sorts of things on which his wise proverbs and songs reflected. And I submit to you, it's not the list that any of us would expect. My hunch is that I could take any group of pious, thoughtful, biblically literate Christians. If they don't know this verse or this chapter, and I'd say, tell me, if you had to summarize the substance, the content of Solomon's wisdom, what would be the main topics? What would be the themes, the subjects? This is not the list you would expect. Here's what the inspired text says. He spoke of trees, from the cedar that is in Lebanon to the hyssop that grows out of the wall. He spoke also of beasts, and of birds, and of reptiles, and of fish, and of paragraph. Nothing about righteousness, nothing about prayer, nothing about obedience, nothing about chastity, all those things we associate with Proverbs. It's a National Geographic special. The source of Solomon's wisdom, wisdom that was applicable in many areas of life, wisdom that for which he is renowned, was reflection on creation. Reflection on the things that God has made. We know that the fear of the Lord is the origin of wisdom. But the trajectory that wisdom takes passes the regions shaped by the givenness of creation. And the chapter ends with a testimony to the universality of Solomon's wisdom, demonstrating that his insights weren't just an Israelite thing. They had universal application. People of all nations came to hear the wisdom of Solomon, and from all the kings of the earth who had heard of his wisdom. The Psalms are given to us as expressions of the deep assumptions about God and his world that should characterize our gut instincts, our assumptions about reality. And in the Psalms, we repeatedly read of a commingling of the themes of the physical order of creation and of moral order. That creation isn't just a lot of randomly selected raw material, but creation has order to it. Psalm 96, for example, in which we read in verses 4 and 5 of God's identity as creator. And it's his identity as creator that distinguishes him from the false gods. For great is the Lord and greatly to be praised. He is to be feared above all gods. For all the gods of the peoples are worthless idols, but the Lord made the heavens. The worthlessness of the idols isn't that they don't work in your personal life. The worthlessness is that they didn't really do anything in creation. And then after an appropriate enjoinder to worship this unique creator God, the psalmist continues by affirming the rule that the Maker has over all he has made. Say among the nations, the Lord reigns. Yes, the world is established. It shall never be moved. He will judge the peoples with equity. This isn't a deist picture of a distant prime mover who winds up the physical clockwork of the cosmos, who establishes mechanical natural laws and then leaves mankind free to invent morality on its own terms. Rather, the fixity of creation is simultaneously physical and moral. And you read this over and over and over in the Psalms. And the Psalms are intended, I believe, to guide our hearts. They're to be the songs of our hearts. They're to give us a kind of basic operating system for how we live in the world. The fixity of creation is simultaneously physical and moral. The one who established the foundations of the earth is the one who will judge the peoples with equity. And the whole creation is depicted not as meaningless raw material awaiting our exploitation or our creativity, but the whole of creation is the worshiping chorus of God. Creation testifies to and praises him for his justice, not just the sheer act of generating the world. As the psalm goes on, let the heavens be glad and let the earth rejoice. Let the sea roar and all that fills it. Let the field exult and everything in it. Then shall all the trees of the forest sing for joy before the Lord, for he comes to judge the earth. He will judge the world in righteousness and the peoples in his faithfulness. So not only does God establish the continuity of the moral and physical order in creation, but the physical world is depicted as delighting in his righteousness. In the biblical picture, the order of the material creation, the form of creation, often described in terms of God setting the foundations of the earth, is not separable from the moral order established in things. That coherence between the structure of the world and the moral order of human life seems to be behind Paul's declaration of moral order in the structure of creation in the first chapter of Romans. Paul insists there that there has been enough evidence in the things that God has made concerning his character and his moral expectations, evidence available ever since the creation of the world, that those who disobey God are without excuse. Not only is the glory of God evident in creation, but the duty of man toward God is also evident, which would seem to include duties concerning how we live in space and time as embodied creatures. So when I say that pre-modern cultures assumed that the order of the cosmos contained clues to the order of society, of culture, of human life, this is an Old Testament witness, this is a New Testament witness. That's why these writers, 1,000 years after Paul, even longer, 1600, Praetorius, still reflecting the idea that the form, the way the organ works, has a kind of fittingness. There's a kind of quality in the form that we need to recognize. The nature of nature, it was long assumed, should inform the structure of culture. One of the manuscripts in the library of Johann Sebastian Bach was a treatise on counterpoint, written in 1725, in which the author referred to art which imitates and perfects nature, but never destroys it. That idea that art imitates nature, which is first articulated in Aristotle, was one that the very Lutheran Bach also embraced. As Bach scholar Christoph Wolff argues, for Bach, art lay between the reality of the world, nature, and God who ordered this reality. Art was a way of seeing things in creation, of perceiving order in creation, and thereby honoring the Creator. In Bach's thinking and in his compositional efforts, musical structure, to use the Latin terminology of the day, harmonia, harmony, Musical structure ultimately refers to the order of nature and to its divine cause. Musical structure isn't just because it feels good to listen to it. Musical structure refers to some cosmic reality. One of Bach's students defined music this way. Music is a mixed mathematical science that concerns the origins, attributes, and distinctions of sound, out of which a cultivated and lovely melody and harmony are made, so that God is honored and praised, but mankind is moved to devotion, virtue, joy, and sorrow. In his masterful biography of Bach, which is subtitled The Learned Musician, Christoph Wolff presents Bach as a musical Newton, a man consciously committed to the discovery of and delight in the ways of God in creation, specifically as those ways could be known in musical form. Because Bach believed that an order in the universe could be perceived, and the order in the universe should properly serve as a model for human making and doing. The order in the universe should be the model for art, as well as for science, for relationships, for law, for agriculture, for politics, perhaps most importantly, for the life of the church. In this older way of perceiving reality, cultural institutions and forms were not arbitrarily or capriciously or willfully engineered and selected, but cultural forms developed and approved in harmony, in resonance with the order that God has established in the cosmos. Culture is the cultivation of created nature, and healthy cultural forms are forms that were faithful to creation. Unhealthy cultural forms were the product of human desire suppressing or denying the created order. Now, if that's all too abstract, again, I alluded to this in the earlier talk, gay marriage isn't just wrong because there's an arbitrary or capricious definition of marriage or definition of sexuality that's offered in special revelation. Gay marriage is a bad cultural institution because it violates the order of creation, something in the nature of things. It is a culture, and if we adopt it, we have adopted a cultural form that isn't just a matter of that violates my preference for law or for custom, but it violates something in the nature of things. And part of what I want to suggest is that the challenge of that the church always faces in contextualizing its message and ministry is to discern to what extent are the cultural changes of this moment fitting, that is, to what extent do the cultural changes give us a better view of reality, or do they, in fact, detract us or distract us or misrepresent reality? I want to offer another kind of glimpse at a period in church history in which the church struggled with cultural change. Of a kind different than that which we're currently struggling with, although in some ways what we struggle with now is derivative of this period. There was a wonderful book written about 20 years ago by historian James Turner, a book called Without God, Without Creed. And the subtitle is The Origins of Unbelief in America. And what Turner is trying to figure out is, why did atheism become a plausible worldview in a relatively short amount of time? He says that in the middle of the 19th century, atheism seemed palpably absurd. It was really hard to find an atheist before the middle of the 19th century. People were probably deists, theists of some sort, but atheism was almost unheard of. It was hard to find an atheist, even during the Enlightenment, even during a period of that we often associate with a strong rejection of Christian truth. But shortly afterwards, unbelief, in Johnson's words, emerged as an option fully available within the general contours of Western culture, a plausible alternative to the still dominant theism. Most people still were theists, but now it wasn't entirely unimaginable for someone to be an atheist, as it was only a few decades prior. And as a historian, he's interested, what happened? How did this change? What happened to make atheism something that was considered an option when it wasn't on the radar before? And As he writes in the introduction to the book, most Americans today continue to believe in God, but it doesn't matter as much as it once did. The option of not believing has eradicated God as a shared basis of thought and experience and retired him to a private or at best subcultural role. The bulk of modern thought has simply dispensed with God. If you wish to understand our own thinking, our public intellectual life, we must know how unbelief became possible. What he does is goes back in Western history, and he goes back as far as the 16th and 17th century with the rise of modern science. And he suggests that as science is developing under the influence of the theorists of Francis Bacon and René Descartes particularly, a new mental world, as he describes it, struggled to be born, a new cast of mind, a new interest in regularity and orderliness, a new mentality that was more comfortable with measurable realities than with the unseen and the mysterious. Suddenly you see the rise, with the rise of modern science, in a fascination about quantities, about measuring things. And in fact, you begin to see philosophies which say that that all of reality can be reduced to kind of a mathematical mathematical formula. There was a new practical set of concerns. Concreteness and precision became more valued attributes of knowledge. Empirical testing, exactitude. There was a time when I got my first digital watch when I was obsessed with having it right to the second. That was an obsession that no one prior to the 17th or 18th century could have ever understood. What's the point of knowing exactly what tenth of a second we're on? That desire for precision emerged. That's a cultural that's a culturally new thing. And a large part of Turner's book is suggesting that this, what he calls rage for experimentation, made it increasingly plausible to thinking people that the scientific method was the only really valid way to understand and engage the world around us. Real knowledge was scientific knowledge. Real knowledge was empirically verifiable knowledge. Real knowledge was measurable knowledge, knowledge that had a quantifiable capacity to it. So that by the late 17th century, church leaders had already begun to revise belief to fit the new intellectual style. Turner writes, "The belief became common that only science could make the world intelligible. Science became the avatar of all knowledge." But it wasn't just scientists who were promoting this new mentality. It was leaders of commercial life. The late 17th century saw a huge increase in the rise of new financial markets, international trade centered in European countries. Theologians and church leaders began worrying about, to use more contemporary language, losing market share. They were eager to make their theology culturally relevant, and they began reframing traditional Christian teaching in terms that fit the temper of the times better. With the result, as Turner writes, the spread of science and commerce tempted many more people with a new image of God, an abstract supreme being who dealt with his cosmos and his creatures through impersonal secondary causes. Since the universe was thought to be more mathematical than purposeful and personal, it seemed to make sense to abandon old theological forms that get in the way of thoughtful modern people, which made the church seem outdated and irrelevant to this new emerging culture. So in time, the picture of God as mysterious and transcendent and as personally involved with creation was eclipsed. It was demoted. An orderly, natural law God fitted the taste for regularity, for clarity, and plainness rather than mystery, for down-to-earth, tangibly experienced hard fact rather than impalpable transcendence. Now, Turner goes on to describe how throughout the 18th century, scientific paradigms began to be the paradigms used to describe God by more and more theologians. God was an engineer. With regard to creation, and he says there emerged a kind of schizophrenic attitude that God is a divine engineer with regard to creation, but personal religious experience, we have Jesus and the Heavenly Father. And so we begin to see the rise of what he calls a bifurcated practical theology. This really, what he's describing, are the roots of what eventually became theological liberalism, in which God's, first through deism and then through theological liberalism, God's identity as personally involved in the lives of all of his creatures is more and more ruled out. Evangelicals, Turner writes, obviously still were orthodox in their theology, but he says that their stress on personal faith, on personal conversion, on the sinner's personal bond with the Savior required a warm and active and personal God. As he writes, one could hardly pour out one's soul to a natural law. And yet, evangelicals began also to bifurcate God's role. So increasingly they saw, they focused their attention on God's role in their salvation, God's redemptive role, and increasingly allowed science to, okay, you guys can describe creation, and we'll accept all your mathematical principles, and we'll accept all this, and yet we still have Jesus in our hearts. And so you begin to see a dualism within evangelicalism trying to retain its high view of the reality of salvation, a kind of dualism which pictured God as having two radically different faces. The side of God that dealt with creation was less personal than Obi-Wan Kenobi's Force. And the Jesus of salvation became very otherworldly and sentimental. Christian discipleship, as a result, didn't have as much to do with culture. Evangelicals, writes Turner, in common with virtually all educated Americans, accepted the divided God of the Enlightenment. The result of all this, over the course of all this time, in Turner's view, is that the church made unbelief seem like a respectable choice for thoughtful Americans. As he writes, in trying to adapt religious belief to socioeconomic change, to new moral challenges, to novel problems in knowledge, to the tightening standards of science, the defenders of God slowly strangled him. Most of the guardians of belief were understandably anxious to keep up with modernity, to bridge the gaps and heal the conflicts between religion and modern society, and this commitment formed their choices. The majority of religious leaders were safe, cautious men. They decided they could best secure knowledge of God by tuning it to the dominant harmonies of the modern world. The church thus played a major role in softening up belief. Theologians were too unwilling to allow God to be incomprehensible, too insistent on bringing him within the compass of mundane human knowledge, too anxious to link belief with science, too neglectful of other roads to knowledge, too insensitive to non-cognitive ways of apprehending reality, say poetry or the arts. Too forgetful, in short, of much of their own traditions as they tried to make God up to date. Unbelief, in conclusion, resulted from the decisions that influential church leaders, lay writers, theologians, ministers, made about how to confront the modern pressures upon religious belief. And the choices taken together boiled down to a decision to deal with modernity by embracing it, to diffuse modern threats to the traditional bases of belief by bringing God into line with modernity. Unbelief emerged because church leaders too often forgot the transcendence essential to any worthwhile God. In other words, when God becomes an engineer only, when God is principally pictured as an engineer, then eventually we can find explanations in mere natural causes to get rid of the engineer. Now, I have a twin purpose in including so much of Philip Turner's analysis here. The first is to show how this dualism has been encouraged in modern culture, the dualism that separates creation from redemption, that separates the physical from the spiritual, that separates our religious life with everyday life, with life in the body. And the second reason is to display the dangers of being overly concerned with defining the gospel in terms that the world finds plausible. It's always a temptation to try to define the gospel in the world's terms so that we can make the gospel more attractive. But the gospel was foolishness to the Greeks, and it will always be foolishness to many, many people. Stanley Hauerwas, in an article called Preaching as Though We Had Enemies, observed, Christians in modernity thought their task was to make the gospel intelligible to the world, rather than to help the world understand why it could not be intelligible without the gospel. This is very reminiscent of the kind of argument that Leslie Newbegin makes in his book, Foolishness to the Greeks, in which he talks about rather than reframing the gospel to fit the world's expectations, we have to try to explain the world to itself using the gospel's expectations. Discipleship involves growing in wise obedience within a specific cultural setting. But within every cultural setting, there's a temptation to adopt our belief to fit that cultural setting. And precisely in our cultural setting, there's been the temptation to assume that creation is meaningless and that redemption is a purely private matter. So, again, this dualism that separates the world of flesh from the world of spirit, that separates the world of, can I say this, religion from the world of culture. We often think when question is raised about the church's relationship to culture, it's always assumed that the church has no intrinsic interest in culture, that the church is just going to use culture as a tool to get an essentially spiritual message out, rather than realizing that if we understood the gospel thoroughly, it would transform our cultural lives as well. This is not just a means for evangelism. I want to say some words about some personal experiences in which I've seen this kind of dualism at work in my own life. As Dr. Stamm has indicated, I worked once for National Public Radio and then worked at a Christian magazine in 1984, began working at Eternity magazine, which was then one of the leading evangelical periodicals. I'd been laid off from my job at NPR because of a complicated financial crisis. And the transition from this progressive secular institution to the rather sleepy world of evangelical journalism was a bit traumatic for me. When I'd worked at NPR, it was a bracing challenge to work as a Christian journalist in a rather hostile setting. But I worked hard to apply my worldview as far as possible within the constraints of that setting. When I went to work at Eternity magazine, I had a new set of challenges. At NPR, I was up against what I'll call a secular form of American dualism, a dualism that presupposed that religious views were subjective, private, and had nothing to do with the world of space and time and history and important ideas. Religion was something you did on your own time, has nothing to do with real life. In the evangelical subculture, there was a parallel dualism at work. Social and cultural issues were not really as important to Christians as the spiritual life. And the spiritual life was subjective, private, had nothing to do with the world of space and time and history and important ideas. It turns out that my secularist friends and my Christian friends basically were working with two different forms of the same kind of dualism, which privatized religion. My secularist friends didn't want religious influence in culture. My Christian friends weren't that interested in culture. In some ways, it was easier being a covert Christian journalist at NPR than an explicit Christian journalist at Eternity magazine. At NPR, my colleagues and I agreed that cultural life was really important. We disagreed on how it should be understood and interpreted. But that it was important, that we should attend to it, was never in dispute, and that's why we were journalists. At Eternity, there was more of a sense of being pastors and teachers who were eager to communicate spiritual truths, which were a set of abstract affirmations about the inner life. Culture was used as a kind of object lesson, like a visual object lesson. I used to call this the flannel graph view of culture. Most of you won't know what a flannel graph is. It was a tool we used to use in Sunday school classes to kind of illustrate things. But there's finally, culture's a set of object lessons to make some theological point. If there's civil war somewhere in Africa, or poverty in American inner cities, or television programs that exalted adultery, or movements in the arts that promoted a spirit of wry irony, well, like any good preacher, we could see these as illustrations of really important things. And once the illustration was used, you could dispense with it. You didn't have to worry about the war in Africa or the television shows. We've made our point. Now we'll go on to talk about the really important things. Efforts to understand these things in any depth, any kind of appreciation of their inner workings, wasn't as highly valued. There had to be a Bible verse quoted every other paragraph, or people would get nervous that we weren't really being Christian. As I said, there was an eerily parallel dualism at work in these two settings. And in many ways, I found it easier to work at NPR, in part because it was less Gnostic. My colleagues there did not appreciate my deepest commitments. They were baffled or offended by what I believed. They did not share my convictions about the Lord of heaven and earth, but they agreed that thoughtful reflection about life on earth was a worthy vocation. In my view, they didn't have any really good reason to believe that, and they had no sound criteria for making any kind of judgments about the quality or merits of ways we were living, but they did have some sense that life on the earth, life in the body, had merit. They did not believe that we were apprentice angels, and neither did I. But my Christian colleagues surely would have said that they believed that our earthly life was important, but they were often just as uncomfortable with evaluating the quality or merits of that life. It often seemed as if the only criteria for cultural health was whether more people were getting saved or not. They were concerned that Christ be honored in public life, but the honoring was verbal, not formal. So, for example, if a prominent general in the army was found to be a committed Christian, that was something to celebrate. And if a prominent pacifist was a sincere believer, that too was cause for rejoicing. The fact that these two people disagreed profoundly about what the teachings of Jesus have to do with how we ought to live in the world wasn't something that Christian journalists should be that concerned about. The important thing is they're one of us, the general and the anti-war protester. They're Christians. That's a good thing. In my view, these differences were precisely the sorts of things Christian journalists should pay attention to. If I were a Christian film reviewer, I would be, in my vocation as a reviewer, less concerned about the personal faith of a director than about the quality of and meaning of the director's work. If I were a Christian critic assigned a review of a novel, the personal convictions of the writer would be of less importance than the quality of prose style, characterization, plot, and other attributes of fiction. The approach to journalism I often encountered among my colleagues in the Evangelical Press Association perpetuated a dualism that separated creation from redemption. During that time, I came to know several really serious journalists, Christian journalists, who were struggling with some of the same problems. One told me she'd written a story that had been syndicated and reprinted in a number of Christian periodicals. When the story appeared in one Christian magazine, many of the facts she had reported had been altered. Names had been changed, conversations among figures in the story totally concocted, events entirely invented. And when she confronted the editor who had made these changes, he piously told her that he felt the message of the story was more powerfully conveyed with the alterations he had made. In other words, his lies were more effective in changing people's hearts than was the truth. And that justified everything. The facts of life in the created realm shouldn't get in the way of the work of bringing people to Jesus. Now, this historic dualism, whereby we think that spiritual ends ought to be achieved through any means possible. Now, granted, that's an extreme case. But we have had this kind of dualism for a long time. It's plagued Christians since the beginning of the church. And it's been exacerbated by the modern assumption that creation is not in any way a guide to culture. Theme we started talking about at the beginning. In the modern view, all cultural institutions and conventions are just social constructions. They serve human needs and desires, but they're not in any way sustained or encouraged by any kind of givenness in nature. And sadly, many Christians have, to one degree or another, assimilated this kind of cultural relativism. In 1948, in an essay, Notes Towards the Definition of Culture, T.S. Eliot asserted, "The most important question we can ask is whether there is any permanent standard by which we can compare one civilization with another and by which we can make some guess at the improvement or decline of our own." I believe if the church hopes to respond wisely to patterns of living and believing that form our culture, we need to make comparative judgments. Unfortunately for us today, many influential leaders shaping American churches seem to be unable to ask this question. As I read the writings of many of these people, I don't find evidence that they believe that we can make even a guess about cultural improvement or decline. They talk about cultural change and say the church has to adapt to cultural change, but whether it's an improvement or a decline seems off the radar. Many of them don't seem to have ever met a cultural trend that they couldn't embrace somehow. But Eliot believed there were such criteria. He thought we could distinguish between advance and retrogression. We could recognize cultural decline as a reality. In the past, most Christians also believed that there was a permanent standard by which one could judge cultural progress or cultural decline. One could ask, for instance, whether God's revealed will for human experience is more or less accomplished by certain changes. One could ask whether the true, the good, and the beautiful are more encouraged by new cultural arrangements. One could ask whether the givenness of nature and human nature are honored or dishonored by some cultural development. But many Christian leaders seem to deny the possibility of making such judgments. With the possible exception of obvious epidemics of immorality, say increased divorce rates or an increase in pornography or some other statistically measurable trend in which more people are committing more obvious sins. But what's missing from the observations of many people guiding the church's cultural engagement is the recognition that cultural forms have consequences. The way, for instance, the omnipresence of technology promotes the deep assumption that we can fix anything. The way in which proliferating mechanisms of convenience erode the virtues of patience and long-suffering. The way in which social institutions that promote radical pluralism undercut the plausibility of exclusive truth claims. Cultural forms convey deep assumptions about reality. Sometimes those forms become dominant in a culture because of what they implicitly affirm, and sometimes they become dominant for economic reasons. But the connotations of cultural forms often are absorbed subconsciously into people's souls. I want to give some examples of that in a minute. What I'm eager to do, however, in this lecture is to argue that some cultural patterns of living, some cultural forms, do more justice to the kinds of creatures we are and the kind of world we live in than others. They're not simply a matter of morality and immorality. Sometimes our society adopts cultural habits that distort or misrepresent important aspects of our human nature. In extreme cases, we might call those forms dehumanizing, but even in lesser cases, they diminish our dignity and honor as bearers of God's image. American Christians have improved in their ability to speak out concerning injustice, which is one form of disordered cultural life, but it's not the only form. Injustice is easier to recognize and to criticize because the person on the receiving end usually knows they're being mistreated. But many of our cultural disorders are market-driven. People like the disorders. The people whose lives they distort often enjoy the distortions. I've been thinking a lot about the culture of celebrity, for instance. I'm actually working on some lectures on the culture of celebrity, and the death of Anna Nicole Smith and Britney's haircut, chronicled nonstop as they have been in the media, is an example of a kind of cultural disorder. People shouldn't care that much about these things. I would say this is a disorder we ought to recognize, and yet there's no obvious victim. No one's complaining about it. Well, the people don't like it, but the people who are gaga to see the next story in the Britney Spears saga, they're suffering. We don't recognize their suffering because they haven't formed some sort of victims' rights group to get special acknowledgement. But they are victims, nonetheless. When people insist on their right to enjoy a disorder, it's difficult for us to speak up. After all, in a market-driven democracy, in a culture that celebrates choice and freedom, it takes a lot of courage to pronounce someone's choice a bad choice. We do this on some matters. We say abortion is a bad choice. Some of us say that. We say that divorce, unwarranted divorce, is a bad choice, but we're less and less willing to speak out publicly about that. I'm going to talk about another pattern of bad choices here, one that I've written about. I mentioned at the beginning of my last lecture, reading Neil Postman's book, Amusing Ourselves to Death, which came out while I was at Eternity Magazine, Public Discourse in an Age of Show Business. It was a book about the threat to civic health, specifically to democracy, of a culture that was more and more invested in being entertained. My book, All Got Children in Blue Suede Shoes, was in some ways inspired by many of Postman's arguments, and I was tempting to make some specific theological and religious applications of some of the insights into that cultural disorder that Postman was describing. And he was describing it as a disorder, not just something he didn't like, something more like a disease, something that objectively threatened civic health. And I agreed with Postman. I believe further that the premium placed on fun in American culture had the potential not only for disordering democracy and public discourse about politics, but it had the potential for having profound disordering effects in the church and in individual souls as well. Well, not long after I wrote All Got Children in Blue Suede Shoes, Pat Robertson, a man who had run for president in an effort to take America back for Jesus, announced his intentions to launch, as part of his growing media empire, a 24-hour-a-day game show network. Now, I'm not sure that Pat Robertson ever read Neil Postman's book, but I wasn't sure that what America really needed was Family Feud played 24/7. But since 1985, when Neil Postman warned us about this, the Christian entertainment industry has exploded. There was a book published about 10 years ago called Entertainment Evangelism. If America was suffering from too much entertainment, conservative Christians didn't seem to notice. This frenzy of fun was in part financially motivated, and many of the people making money from Christian show business are not Christians. They're combining the insights of P.T. Barnum with those of George Barna, and they've sussed out that there's gold in their holy hills. This aspect of CCM, by the way, was lampooned several years ago on an episode of The Sopranos when Tony's ditzy and conniving sister started writing worship and praise music on a cheap Casio keyboard with a guy she'd met in rehab. Explained to Tony this was the fastest growing segment of the recording industry. Tony thought, okay, you're writing that Jesus music, it's fine, you're going to make money on it. Now, there are sincere Christians in this business, not just people who are opportunistic, but I sometimes wonder whether they're worried that America is amusing itself at least into a stupor, if not to death. This isn't a problem, it's a ministry opportunity. Now, of course, God will use these things. God, I'm not saying these are useless or sinful, or I think our obsession with entertainment is unwise. God uses all sorts of things to accomplish his purposes, which says a lot about God, but not necessarily the things he uses. He used Balaam's ass and Judas to accomplish some of his purposes, but that doesn't make them role models for us. I'm not saying these things can't be used. I'm not saying they're produced for insincere manners or, you know, the best of intentions. But we do want to step back and ask, are we adding momentum to a disorder when we adopt the ways of the world for the best of intentions? The addiction to entertainment is a social and spiritual problem. There was a recent article in the Chronicle of Higher Education by an English professor at Emory University who cited a number of studies and surveys which indicated that today's college students are increasingly indifferent to and uninformed concerning history, civics, geography, politics, literature, and the arts. For example, 64% of young people 15 to 26 could name the latest American Idol, while only 10% could identify the name of the Speaker of the House of Representatives. 15 to 26, most of these people can vote, okay? And they'll vote for the American Idol. In 2002, the National Geographic Society conducted a global geographic literacy survey. 39% of American 18 to 24-year-olds failed it. 29% could not identify the Pacific Ocean. Now, these are not just college students. These are voters whose collective wisdom will guide our nation's future. The problem of intellectual and social disengagement of students was also addressed by Mark Edmondson, who's an English professor at the University of Virginia, in an article written 10 years ago in Harper's and reprinted in his recent book, Why Read. Edmondson, who's no friend to the church, I should say, Edmondson perceptively identified some of the deeper personal liabilities of a culture in which entertainment rules. He observed very few of his students are seriously engaged with what they are studying. By the way, the article that I cited from the Chronicle of Higher Education was called A Very Long Disengagement. Edmondson says very few of his students are seriously engaged with what they're studying. Not only with what they're studying, with what they believe. They have beliefs, but they're kind of detached from their beliefs. Or with what's going on in the world. Now, these are students at the University of Virginia, which is an elite educational institution. And these are people who will be in positions of incredibly significant social leadership. I mean, one of the reasons a lot of kids go to UVA is to begin to network and to get power in state and national government. And these young people in Edmondson's diagnosis also lack passion. I want to read from that article. University culture, like American culture writ large, is, to put it crudely, ever more devoted to consumption and entertainment. By the way, this is more than a decade after amusing ourselves to death. Devoted to consumption and entertainment, to the using and using up of goods and images. For someone growing up in America now, there are very few available alternatives to the cool consumer worldview. My students didn't ask for that view, much less create it, but they do bring a consumer Weltanschauung to school, where it exerts a powerful and largely unacknowledged influence. How did my students reach this peculiar state in which all passion seems to be spent? By the way, I want to add, cut out a piece in this interview. He talks about how he never sees students who really argue about anything. And he longs to see students who love the truth enough to argue about things. And one day he was walking on the grounds and he overheard what sounded like a very heated argument. He was thrilled. His heart just, you know, leapt inside him. And he wandered over to where he heard this two students, a male and female, arguing. It turns out it was a role-playing exercise for a class. And it was so disheartening. They lack passion. How did my students reach this peculiar state in which all passion seems to be spent? I think that many of them have imbibed their sense of self from consumer culture in general and from the tube in particular. They're the progeny of 100 cable channels and omnipresent blockbuster outlets. TV, Marshall McLuhan famously said, is a cool medium. Those who play best on it are low-key and not assertive. They blend in. Enthusiasm quickly looks absurd. The form of character that's most appealing on TV is calmly self-interested, though never greedy, attuned to the conventions, and ironic. Judicious timing is preferred to sudden self-assertion. The TV medium is inhospitable to inspiration, improvisation, failures, slip-ups. All must run perfectly. Naturally, a cool youth culture is a marketing bonanza for producers of the right products, who do all they can to enlarge that culture and keep it grinding. The internet, TV, and magazines now teem with what I call persona ads. Ads for Nikes and Reeboks and Jeeps and Blazers that don't so much endorse the capacities of the product per se as show you what sort of person you are once you've acquired it. The Jeep ad that features hip outdoorsy kids whipping a frisbee from mountaintop to mountaintop isn't so much about what Jeeps can do as it is about the kind of people who own them. Buy a Jeep and be one with them. The ad is of little consequence in itself, but expand its message exponentially and you have the central thrust of current consumer culture. Buy in order to be. Most of my students seem desperate to blend in, to look right, not to make a spectacle of themselves. The specter of the uncool creates a subtle tyranny. It's apparently an easy standard to subscribe to, this Tarantino-like cool. But once you're committed to it, you discover that matters are rather different. You're inhibited, except on ordained occasions, from showing emotions, stifled from trying to achieve anything original. You're made to feel that even the slightest departure from the reigning code will get you genially ostracized. This is a culture tensely committed to a laid-back norm. Now let's assume for the sake of argument that Edmondson is right, that he's diagnosed something correctly. Let's assume that there is a link between a cultural style that brings together the technology and social system that is television and advertising and the twin activities of entertainment and consumption. If this matrix of experience does have the kind of debilitating, disengaging effects that Mark Edmondson, Mark Bauerlein, and others have described, then it's clearly not a good thing for our children or for society. And one would hope that pastors, Christian educators, and parents would be eager to guide their children along other paths. And yet it seems, from my unscientific data gathering, that the media habits of Christian young people are often, on average, virtually indistinguishable from that of their peers. Now, let me underline my main point. Cultural institutions and practices should be shaped by the nature of nature and human nature. They should honor created order by encouraging an experience of society and of nature that fits who we are and what the world is. That's my general principle. And specifically in this case, given the kinds of creatures that we are, given the ways that human societies work, a well-ordered society requires a certain level of attentiveness and moral seriousness and passion to run well. It doesn't happen naturally, or it doesn't happen when those who have responsibility are careless and negligent. Furthermore, there are blessings of an intellectual and aesthetic nature that enrich our experience of human life, blessings which historically have been passed on under the custodianship of what we call higher education. Universities have been places where these natural goods, their blessings bestowed on the just and the unjust, common grace blessings, have been preserved and transmitted. But what Postman and many others have argued is that the role of entertainment in our culture has gotten way out of balance. The court jester is running the kingdom, and he's working mostly for his own benefit. This is a disorder in the nature of societies. Human society and human well-being are seriously diminished when entertainment has such a central role in society. It's disordering for individuals as well as for society as a whole. Given the created shape of human nature, you can't increase the priority of entertainment without doing damage somewhere else. Now, if all that's true, then how might we account for the fact that American churches have displayed an unprecedented level of concern with staying in sync with the culture of entertainment in the past two decades? If entertainment is a problem for American life, if it disorders the lives of our neighbors, then why are American churches mimicking these disordered cultural patterns? In trying to be charitable, I can only include that the people making these decisions really don't take cultural life that seriously. In the interest of evangelism, American churches have tried to associate the gospel with whatever fashionable trends Americans are attracted to, without taking seriously the cultural meaning embedded in those forms. And this is why I often learn more from non-Christian cultural observers than from Christians. Christians are far too eager to figure out how they can exploit some new trend. They're too eager to do that to take the time to ask what the trend means. Non-Christian cultural critics, people for whom culture is all they have, tend to have more wisdom about such matters. Some Christians, just want folks to get to heaven, so they're in too much of a hurry to really understand what's going on here on earth. But many smart and perceptive non-Christian writers assume that here is all we have, and so they want to be as real about it as possible. When Christian leaders add the momentum of the church to the surfeit of entertainment, it's not just bad for the church, it's bad for the world. Peace I give unto you, not as the world gives, give I unto you. Jesus' claim to the disciples reminds us. It's a challenge to the church to ask whether it is offering the world something that the world itself cannot give, or are we just giving back what the world already has with a fish sewn on it? Caring only about evangelism and not about discipleship means that we fail to call people to an entire renewed life across their cultural experience in a way that's remarkably different from the world's way, in a way that honors creation and human nature and honors the commands of God. In closing, there's a very interesting parallel to this in this situation that we're in now, of the culture of the church's adoption of the techniques of entertainment culture to that of the 19th century, in which the American church leaders and theologians tried to adapt Christian theology and practice to fit a mentality or cultural style dominated by scientific mentality. And the result was a bifurcated God and eventually the cultural acceptance of atheism. In the late 20th and early 21st century, church leaders have been eager to reframe Christian worship and Christian proclamation in forms that are more compatible with an entertainment-driven consumer culture. I'm not sure what results we'll see. Future generations will write books about it. My urgent concern is that church leaders have not been attending enough to the question of what happens after evangelism. The church is being assimilated into disordered patterns of the broader culture, because its leaders don't seem to take culture seriously enough enough, that is, that is, they don't take the necessity of encouraging its members to have healthy cultural lives. Eugene Peterson, in his book Christ Plays in 10,000 Places, observes that it is the task of the Christian community to give witness and guidance in the living of life in a culture that is relentless in reducing, constricting, and enervating life. It's very easy for us to assume that we'll allow the culture to define how to live life and we'll add some supplementary spirituality to season the life nicely, preserve it just long enough for rapture or death, whichever comes first. But that clearly doesn't fit into the biblical account of creation and redemption. It doesn't fit the inner logic of the Great Commission, which doesn't tell us to make converts. It tells us to make disciples, disciples of the Lord of heaven and earth, who has all authority in heaven and earth, teaching them to observe everything he has commanded. The task of the church, again, is not just to do evangelism, but it is to teach its members to honor Christ's lordship in every aspect of their lives. Thank you. We do have time for a few questions, if that's desirable. Thank you.
If there are questions, let me ask you to come to one of these two microphones and perhaps tell us who you are and have a brief question. We're in an entertainment mentality, and silence is very, very. How much silence would NPR allow?
Yeah, dead air. We try to sell a funding credit in the middle of it. It might sound like a commercial.
Yes. All right. My name's Travis. I'm kind of from the Nashville music industry myself.
Yeah.
But two different questions. One's related to that. How do you feel Christians should take entertainment such as Christian music and all of that and use it effectively? And the other is, since we've gone through kind of like the scientific, Darwinism, all that kind of stuff, evolution, and then we went, and now we're kind of in entertainment, what do you think is kind of the next phase that's going to be our biggest battle?
Yeah, I don't know. Let me talk about the first one. I mean, I think that, I got involved in radio originally because I wanted to use Christian music in a kind of witnessing way, in some way. And again, I wasn't at the time thinking at all about the kind of the broader structure of entertainment culture. I also wasn't that interested in the quality of the music, as it turned out. I mean, if it had a good message, that was the important thing, sadly. I guess the first thing I'd say is I think we shouldn't regard music principally as a tool for some other end. I think it's appropriate for us to see music as an end in itself. And it's a good thing. It's a good thing in and of itself. And I think that I think we still have this kind of Gnostic nervousness about delighting in music as a good gift of God. And so I generally say that when we think of that, the term would be used an instrumental use of any cultural phenomena, whether it be providing food for people or putting on concerts, when we think of it only as a means to some other end, we will always be denigrating the thing itself and not allowing it to have its own virtues. So I guess I think it would be great if, I think, again, Christians are nervous about just enjoying culture as a good gift of God. I don't think we ought to be nervous about it. So I'm less interested in the kind of strategic or tactical thought about how do we use this, and more interested in, I mean, in a sense, what's happened is because of the fact that we have this temptation to have this instrumental approach. I think that's one of the other reasons we don't back off and say, well, maybe there are already enough entertainers or enough bands or enough movie. I mean, I don't want to just restrict it to movies or to music. And that maybe part of the task of the church. Well, two things. First of all, there are a lot of seekers who are tired of the surfeit of entertainment in contemporary culture. But most seeker-sensitive churches won't be places where they will find comfort. I knew a lot of people at NPR who were really turned off by the kind of frenetic, entertainment-driven culture. And really hungry for something that transcended that in some way. And so I would say that in terms of ministry, you know, the church needs to look at people who are alienated from that experience as much as anything else. But then, I tend to think more, not so much about, I tend to think more about the church's own life first, that part of our task is, as particularly as we raise our children, to raise children who don't have that kind of need to be entertained in order to be happy, a need to be distracted in order to be happy. And I think that there will be, in fact, a witness to the world. You know, a lot of the world of entertainment has a kind of restlessness about it. You know, a desire to find the next new titillating thing, and particularly the restlessness of making sure you're up to date, making sure you're not liking the band that you're not supposed to like. It's that's so 2006 to like that band, and so there's a kind of anxious restlessness about it. You know, what if Christians were people who loved wonderful forms of art and popular culture without that kind of restlessness, didn't feel anxious, you know, that didn't feel anxious about it. I mean, again, I said in All God's Children, I still think that there are all kinds of wonderful opportunities for delight in popular culture as well as in high culture, as long as we don't become slaves to the system that is delivering them, and as long as we don't become kind of subject to some of the disordered sensibilities that are attached to them. And I talk a lot about the necessity of novelty, for instance. So, you know, I think among popular cultural institutions, it would be great to see Christians who were sustaining cultural institutions that didn't have that kind of preoccupation with being fashionable. There are a lot of small clubs, for instance, that cater to singer-songwriters who never will have a national reputation, local singers. It seems to me, rather than trying to push to get a national band known, not that it's wrong, but you know, we ought to ask, well, how can we serve our community in ways that are unconventional, rather than... if part of the problem is the whole conventional structure of the entertainment business, then how can you provide entertainment? Maybe I'm finally getting around to answering your question in a way that doesn't participate in all of those, in all of the disabilities of the systems. Yes.
Your parting shot was regarding the Great Commission, and yes. Traditional Southern Baptist ideology is that the Great Commission reads "Go evangelize,"
yes.
Neither of which words are actually in the
right.
Text. And my question is, can you point me to examples in our culture of people who are actually making disciples, people who are capable of honoring and carrying out the commands of Christ, and not merely marking notches on their gun belts?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think there are a lot of pastors. I think there are a lot of very faithful pastors who accept the obligation over time to be pastors and to train people in faithful discipleship over the long haul. I think Eugene Peterson, who I quoted near the end of the talk. I certainly there would be things I would disagree with him theologically, but I think his vision of what a pastoral ministry is about makes a lot of sense. He wrote a book, I think his first book was called A Long Obedience in the Same Direction. And just in that title, suggesting what the ideal of a pastoral ministry is encouraging people to be disciples for the long haul. And that is a kind of slow, obviously, quiet, non-dramatic kind of vocation. And again, it's very countercultural to commit yourself to that kind of ministry. And a ministry that you may not live long enough to see the fruit being born in the lives of the people you're caring for. So I think that there are, you know, and I know a number of pastors. You'll never know them. They'll never have national celebrity because they're pastors of churches of about 150 or 200 people. And they're not trying to secure any kind of celebrity. They haven't, they're not marketing some technique that you can kind of use as a template to build disciples because they're like organic farmers. I mean, they're there in that specific place and they're just caring for those particular people. So I think, and I'm, you know, I say critical things about the church leaders, and I don't mean to blanket criticism. I think that the celebrity church leaders are often, not always, but are tempted, I think, to kind of find a kind of an industrial strength technique that's going to fix things. It's interesting. The Great Commission. I grew up in a church that was very missions conscious, and you know, we just extracted into all nations. You know, our interest in the Great Commission was the fact that it meant sending foreign missionaries. But we didn't think about discipleship that much, and we certainly didn't think about what we can call the preamble to the Great Commission. All authority in heaven and earth has been given to me. Therefore, I don't think I've ever heard a sermon on that passage. That what is the consequences of the all authority in heaven and on earth has been given to me, and all of the parallel passages in Colossians 1:15-20, where Christ's authority over everything. It is mandated. Discipleship is in the context of Christ's authority over all of reality. And so that means that we have kind of whole earth discipleship. But again, that's, I think that the reason, you know, that this, now again, it's character in some way, but it's a legitimate character. The preoccupation with a narrowly understood notion of salvation. I think that's in part a function of that 19th century dualism that James Turner is describing. Yes. I'll try to give a short answer.
Thank you so much. I appreciate what you do. I taught last semester at a private Catholic college, and I was very discouraged by many of the things that you mentioned today. I don't even know what to ask, but I am wondering whether to go back, and I think there's a great need. And I just wondered, do you have suggestions for...
Particularly on the staff at a college. Yeah.
Just what to do with these college kids who are going to be our leaders.
Yeah, I think I have a daughter at William & Mary and a son at UVA. So a lot of my, I didn't quote them, but a lot of my intelligence gathering is a result of things I hear back from them also, which confirm, you know, almost every other week, it's interesting, the Chronicle of Higher Education will have a lament by one. It's often people who probably are liberal, although Mark Bauerlein's more conservative. There is a widespread concern among teachers for what they're working with, and I don't want to blame the students. And Mark, neither of these guys that I quoted, Bauerlein and Edmondson, they're not blaming the students. In a sense, they've grown up within a setting within which the sovereignty of their identity as a sovereign consumer is just, and that dispassionate quality that he talks about. My daughter said shortly after she was at William & Mary that she couldn't find anybody who would be willing to talk about anything for more than 5 minutes. Nobody who talked about anything they learned in class and related it to life. And no one who was really willing to argue. She started college in an election year. She started in 2004 and really was looking forward to arguments about politics on campus, and just didn't happen much. I kept assuring her that there were probably other students like her, but that it would be hard to find them because there weren't many settings within which they would gather. It turns out she did. I told her she should start a P.G. Woodhouse Society because she's a big fan of P.G. Woodhouse's fiction. I said, go walk around campus carrying a copy of P.G. Woodhouse and, you know, get people to talk about his books. She didn't take me up on that. I guess the first thing that comes to mind is if you can find any students who have that kind of serious, and maybe serious isn't the right word because it suggests a kind of somberness, but a kind of an attentive curiosity about something, to figure out any way to kind of organize groups of students and to get them talking with each other about those common interests. The reason I mentioned to my daughter about P.G. Woodhouse, rather than, you know, get together a discussion group on some heavier topic or weightier topic, is because, again, I think that would probably scare a lot of students off to have something really, you know, we're going to get together and discuss the demerits of existentialism or something like that. But you can take even fun things really seriously and talk about them and have some sense of engagement with them. It's interesting that both those people I quoted use the term engagement. And I like that term because it, as a Christian person, God gave us this world and put us in the world and gave us all the delightful opportunities that we've corrupted, but gave us all the delightful opportunities expecting us to be engaged in creation. That our cultural lives are not some accident, or it's not what we're doing just until Christ returns. You know, I believe that because of the doctrine of the resurrection of the body, that we're going to have some kind of cultural lives all the time into eternity, some kind. I don't know what exactly. But we will be doing something. We know we're going to be music. There will be music involved. I know that. So to encourage, again, that kind of engagement so that we're not just tolerating life, but finding serious delight. That's not much practical advice, but I'd start there. Thank you.